Semi-crazy, I think that's less than most. My delusions aren't quite up to snuff. I see the news, a rag soiled with lies. It only gets love when somebody's died. See the cars zip past the crosswalks. Watch you hurry, a wander to the sky. Boring job, one that's gonna kill ya. Turn on, tune in, drop out.
Welcome, one and all, to Professor Metal's Irate Debate and Calamitous Commentary with the Philosophical Chain Gang. Today's episode, Nuclear Power and the Environment. What can green do for you? I'm your host, Professor Metal.
I'm Sean.
I'm Bruce.
And I'm River. Hey guys, I got in the Watch It Grow breeder reactor kit from Metalcorp today.
Oh yeah, how's that work?
Well, I just drop it into a tank of water, press the starter, and watch it grow.
Oh, that's neat.
Where do all my sea monkeys go?
Yeah, nuclear power. And, of course, the environmental impact. This is something that's been talked about a lot over the years. Of course, nuclear power has been around for decades at this point as an alternative to many other forms of power generation, both fuel burning and the renewable power generations like damming and wind farms and stuff like that. But it's definitely still something that's being talked about.
Well, let's start here. We're not talking about nuclear weapons. We're not talking specifically about the effects of the ability to convert civilian nuclear material into weapons of mass destruction and the danger that that proposes. We're talking specifically about the impacts in an environmental sense, the environmental ethics of the use of nuclear power in a purely peaceful way. We recognize that there are other issues, but there's only so much time in an episode, so tonight we're going to focus on specifically how the ethics of use of a power source that is, in all honesty, a little imperfect, impacts decision-making and policy setting for that kind of process.
It's getting better. One thing we're starting to recognize is that everything's imperfect.
Certainly, the construction of dams have disrupted the migration of fish and threatened both local natural and civic areas.
And turbines have a tendency to kill birds and cause all sorts of problems for bird migration and nesting.
Both wind and solar are very variable depending on the time of year, month, day.
Wave power has the danger of disrupting sea life in the areas that it's anchored into and used in.
The one thing that's constant is that when we have these new emerging technologies, there are going to be unintended consequences. We're going to have to wrestle them, and then we're going to have to reevaluate them against each other. But there's never going to be a silver bullet. And I've heard some policymakers say, you know, just wait for the perfect technology. In the meantime, muddle along with mostly petrochemicals. But we're starting to become more and more aware of the consequences of using petrochemicals. So we kind of rebalance them against each other.
A lot of these renewable resources have been, in some ways, framed as that silver bullet, even though we are starting to get the unintended consequences.
You know, we're not moving from a perfect technology to an imperfect technology. We're moving from one set of imperfections to another. Not just petrochemicals, not just carbon-emitting options. There are all sorts of ways that we generate power, and the vast majority of them have one kind of problem or another. There is no perfect motion machine that captures just ambient happenings so that magic energy is produced. So, barring some magic solution, which I agree is not likely to come along, what do we do in the meantime? How do we get along in the world and try to make the least negative impact that we possibly can on the world we live in? It seems like nuclear is a pretty good option. It has some definite downsides, but it's also gotten a lot safer since the days of the Chernobyl and Three Mile Island incidences.
Oh, certainly. I mean, materials and architectural design in general have improved, like reactor housing. Various other fail-safes have been put in place or increased to the point where it's very hard to have a nuclear accident anymore unless there's, you know, some form of willful ignorance going on.
And this is one thing that nuclear has an advantage over all of the others, And I'm not saying if it has an advantage that it should be the only thing. I think we should stay somewhat diversified because we never know what's coming next as an unintended consequence. But one advantage that it has is that its downsides are very improvable by technology. There's only so much we can do about the effects of dams on fish. There's only so much we can do about the effects of carbon emissions. There's only so much we can do. I would say that wind and solar can also be improved through better electrical storage. But I think that the advances that have been made in nuclear over the last few decades have moved on ahead, or at least, you know, in the technology that we know, have moved on ahead that where we really should reevaluate its risk portfolio compared to the others, because it is very, very improvable.
Well, and if we're going to talk about the downsides of nuclear, we're definitely going to have to talk about the elephant in the room, the most recent nuclear disaster, Fukushima, which, of course, was terrible. Terrible management went into the problem. Poor planning went into the problem. There were all sorts of issues. But largely, a very catastrophic earthquake and tsunami combo managed to take down a reactor, but not in a critical kind of way, not in the way that we expect from what we usually think of as nuclear disaster sites.
Certainly, and a lot of people conflate Fukushima and Chernobyl because they are probably the two largest nuclear disasters we've had. Mind you, Chernobyl was what is referred to as a criticality event. Basically, the reactor became super hot and melted down, releasing a lot of radiation into the surrounding area. Fukushima, by comparison, was a much lighter of an event. There wasn't as much fallout. It didn't spread as widely as Chernobyl. The fact that it didn't go critical, the core was just exposed to some seawater, means that the overall environmental toll was less. The fact that they're currently working on the zone of exclusion around Fukushima and that it will be available for public use much sooner than the Chernobyl zone of exclusion is proof of that.
Well, and that brings us to one of the technologies associated with nuclear that we don't often think of as a nuclear safety technology, but that plays a huge part, and that's our ability to clean up the mess afterwards. We often think of redundant systems and various kinds of new linings and materials that make it safer to actually have the reaction going on. We rarely think of the amount of damage that we're able to clean up, including the after effects, leftover ground radiation. Basically, we don't think about this as a part of the picture of nuclear technology. The ability to clean up, the deeper understanding that we have of how radiation affects things, and the ability to target our cleanup efforts to have the most value we possibly can. Whereas when we talk about the nuclear disasters of the past, we're generally talking about something where we didn't fully understand, not that we do now, but where we understood much less of what was going on and how to most effectively try and prevent harm from it.
On the one hand, it's worth mentioning that each time there's one of these disasters, we learn a lot of lessons about how to prevent that kind of disaster the next time. On the other hand, it's kind of fair for people to respond with, well, that's what you said last time. How many of these are we going to have to go through before we have solved it? We don't know. I suppose it depends on your view of technological progress and how much you trust the concept of technological progress, and not everyone does.
Well, I think also part of the resistance to nuclear energy is that because it has nuclear in the title and it uses the same science and force that, say, nuclear weapons do, people will think nuclear and not think of relatively clean, fairly efficient power, but think of the mushroom cloud, the giant explosion, all that, all of the testing that was done, the only two ever nuclear attacks in human history, of course. And I think that the fact that those aren't separated in the cultural zeitgeist definitely lends to the antagonism of nuclear energy as a viable energy source.
For a serious consideration of this, one has to take into account the fact that there are a wide variety of different technologies under this umbrella term at this point, and that they have completely different risk profiles.
All right, I'll play devil's advocate for a minute here. When something goes horribly wrong with wind turbines, some birds die, When something goes horribly wrong with nuclear, the stakes are much higher. The stakes are not a few birds die and we shut the turbines down until we figure out how to deal with it if we're that concerned about the birds. The stakes are possibly generational. Fish that have damaged their genetic structure, possibility of toxic waves that cause whole areas to be over-oxygenated in the ocean, killing off local populace, which in some cases allows for a ripple effect that leads to toxic algae blooms, which can put toxins into the entire food supply. While we haven't seen an event of the scale that it was world-ending yet, the potential is there with nuclear for a much bigger mess than any other technology we have. So given a risk-reward structure, considering that there's a much higher possibility of something going wrong with nuclear, shouldn't we look for other options instead?
Well, I definitely think we should look for other options. I think that nuclear is a viable fuel source that we can use right now, that we have the technology for, and we're working on making that technology better and safer and more efficient. There's so much more we could be drawing power-wise from a nuclear reactor. The fact that there are entire teams of scientists dedicated to the material sciences of, like, reactor housing or coolant systems that are trying to create more and better metals and concretes and things of that ilk that are better at holding up to radiation, which is probably one of the biggest problems in what can cause these problems in the first place, the degradation of materials to the point that it causes a fatal flaw in the reactor and causes a criticality event or a meltdown. The fact that there is, in the very near future, going to be so many more safeties in place, and there are already so many more than there were 30 years ago at Chernobyl. There are even more now than there were at Fukushima, which was only a handful of years ago. And as Bruce said, the fact that we learned so much from it, from Fukushima and from Chernobyl, means that it's going to be an ever safer source of energy.
I think when we talk about the risk of nuclear, it's not just one variable. Nuclear is a very, very low risk of a very, very high consequence failure. Whereas opposed to others have a almost certain chance of a very small consequence of damage. It's sort of like playing the reverse lottery. You have a very, very, very low chance of having a huge catastrophe, as opposed to something where you're almost certainly going to do a little bit of environmental damage, which is going to gradually add up. But even so, it's not going to be a disaster, at least not yet.
Okay, but one could also say that the development of new technologies to try and make nuclear safer costs resources. It costs money, it costs time, and it costs the energy of scientists who could be in the power generation field in general, producing other technologies or working on improving other technologies. So continuing to dedicate resources and energy to nuclear means committing to a path involving nuclear in the first place. Why should we make that initial commitment rather than putting our resources elsewhere?
I'm so glad you asked. The thing is, the research into nuclear sciences as a whole doesn't just help nuclear power. It helps things like space travel. When you are outside of a planet's magnetic field, you're being bombarded constantly with much higher amounts of cosmic radiation than you would be, like, say, on the face of Earth, where you're still getting some because you still have the sun and random winds and the fact that we kind of saturated the atmosphere with ionized radiation back in the 50s and 60s. But the fact that you have you're making materials that can stand up to this radiation means that you're going to be able to create space stations or spaceships that can hold up much, much longer before failing because they aren't going to be falling apart because of the radiation that is inherent in the distance between worlds.
I imagine there are a lot of industries and areas in which those technologies have secondary positive effects other than outer space. Outer space exploration itself has lots of secondary effects for other industries and improves our lives in a lot of ways. If nuclear does something similar, then great.
The fact that we're making materials that are hardened against radiation means that we would be able to potentially more expediently contain and clean up areas that there have been nuclear accidents, say the Chernobyl zone of alienation or the Fukushima zone of alienation, two areas that are currently depopulated because of the radiation left over from those disasters. If we can create machines that are resistant to radiation, as well as hazard suits and things of that ilk, we would be able to bring more people in and be able to better contain the affected ground and water and air.
I see two major problems with what you're saying, River. The two of them link together, but I'll start with the more obvious of the two. There wouldn't be any nuclear accidents to clean up if we weren't pursuing nuclear power. If we shut the reactors down, we wouldn't have any further accidents to clean up. Thus, we don't need better technology to clean up accidents. Secondly, if we're pursuing space exploration and following all of these other things that the materials can be used for, why put energy into that if we can't even maintain the world we've already got?
That's a very good question, and I definitely agree that we should be trying to maintain the world we have, as well as expanding outward, not necessarily out of a imperial need to see humans on the face of every planet, but because we as a species have long been explorers, scientists, we've been thinkers. I mean, that's the whole point of what we're doing here, is it's thought. I think that answers, in some ways, both questions. Why are we using nuclear energy? Well, we have the science. The science is freely available. It seems like a better option, with some exceptions, to just wholesale burning of coal and other petrochemicals. Now, I definitely think there are positives to certainly working on developing renewable resources. I think part of the problem, though, is the fact that with a lot of renewable resources, their own problems aside, comparably, there is so many more, like wind turbines or hydroelectric dams or wave generators, that you need to produce the same amount of electricity. And I think it's a much harder sell to try and say, hey, maybe we should cut back on electricity, or we're going to forcibly cut back on electricity to help mitigate that. And I definitely think nuclear power is a cleaner, in some ways, form of electricity that we can put money into, and it produces pretty much all the power we want.
Well, it seems to me that like what we're trying to do with all of these situations is manage risk, the different kinds of risks that each one has and the different risk profiles. So what's often a good strategy for managing risk is diversification. So instead of talking about it like, you know, just hydroelectric or just solar needs to be the future or just nuclear needs to be the future, we probably need to look at a wide spectrum of how they can complement each other. The ways that nuclear could fit in well is that it has advantages that aren't particularly seasonal or cyclical by time. It also, depending on where the technology goes, can be located anywhere. It's not specific to certain local environmental factors, so maybe it could go in the places where those local environmental factors aren't available.
I think there's a case to be had for the complementing technologies, and on some level, though, isn't there a zero-sum game being played with research dollars? Ignoring the problems with a larger footprint, because I think there are things you can say on both sides of that. It's a larger footprint necessary for renewables, but it also maybe is a lighter footprint, so maybe that balances out. I think there are a lot of other places you can go with that discussion, but specifically as it pertains to developing the technologies into the form that they will be in the future, isn't there a zero-sum game being played with research dollars for developing better solar panels or blacker materials to back solar power panels with, or better turbines that kill less birds, or better nuclear turbines and better capture technologies? I mean, can we really develop all of them at once? Yes, we could build all of them at once, but we're not at the point of just building all of them. we're in a development phase.
I think we're inevitably going to be developing some of them. I don't think any kind of policy is going to actually completely shut down research on, you know, it's not like let's say we decide as a society to do a concentrated focus on nuclear, there's still going to be some people working on solar, maybe not to the same degree. But yeah, I don't think any of these research programs are just going to stop completely.
Well, that, and I think there is some amount of diminishing returns. Like, there's certainly you could put all of your research dollars into one specific thing, but after a certain point, you kind of just throwing money around. Like, there's only so much that is required, and even after how much is required to research, how much extra to make that research maybe go a little faster. At a certain point, people are just standing around or sitting on their thumbs doing nothing until tests come back, until they kind of get the results of what their newest theory is. And I think that you definitely want to diversify your research dollars to get the most impact out of them, instead of just saying, we are all going to go after nuclear, or we're going to all go after wind, or we're all going to go after sea-based wave electrical generation, which would just end up, aside from kind of lopsiding research, definitely not bringing back as much return as one would hope.
To the extent any one of these areas could be said to have been tried to have been shut down, it would be nuclear. I mean, over the last 30 years, it's been all but a moratorium on it, and yet, at least the theoretical research has continued. One place where I do think there really is a zero-sum game, and we're doing it completely wrong, is in the age of the actual nuclear plants that we have. We're not building any more nuclear plants right now. We say, we're going to stop right there. But what that does is, that makes all of the plants we have getting older and older, and we know that older plants are less safe. So this is exactly the opposite of what we should want. We should say, okay, if we're going to stop having X nuclear plants, we should start replacing them with the new technologies. Phase out the old, bring in the new. And then if we decide we want to have more, we could do that, but not make them more of the new ones, not the old ones.
So that actually raises an interesting point, which I think might have a little bit more teeth than the last. If we are looking to fund technologies that can replace the current infrastructure, isn't there an inherent bias in nuclear's favor? In that, A, it's a proven technology, it does generate power at the appropriate levels, and it's able to go online much sooner than more productive renewable resources would. As such, if your funding is coming from a system that has an interest in turning a profit off of that technology, won't they want to subsidize the one that can be, A, implemented faster, and B, has already shown that it's a profitable technology?
I certainly think there is some bias, at least from a business standpoint, in nuclear's favor, but only so much, especially with public opinion the way it is, as concerns to nuclear, especially after events like Chernobyl and events like Fukushima. So there's going to be a lot of civil pushback, a lot of social pushback. You're going to have things like protests from people who maybe don't want to see it in their town or anywhere or in their state or anywhere close by, and you're going to see a lot of, like, maybe legislation passed to tax it. While easier to set up, maybe a less optimal plan for investors. And I definitely think that while it is a proven technology, there are a lot of people out there that want to develop the new nuclear reactors, the fancier, for lack of a better term, more productive, more with a higher output and things like that.
I feel like that's a pretty fair airing of the anti-case, the anti-nuclear development case, so I'm going to take that hat back off at this point and go back to speaking for myself rather than trying to advocate for another position. One of the things I think is really interesting going forward about the possibilities that nuclear power provides us is that some of the new reactors, being so much safer and cleaner than some of the old reactors, means the possibility of putting that power generation capability into very remote places that otherwise don't have the same opportunity that we have in the severely overdeveloped Western world. It may be fine and well for us to think about using solar power instead of using nuclear because it's a safer technology overall and it's better for the environment in the long run. But in a place like West Africa, where power is desperately needed now, and it's difficult to set up something expensive like that without local unrest becoming a serious problem, the new generation of nuclear reactors might be a real viable opportunity for people who are otherwise living with power cuts on an ongoing basis to have a consistent stream of electricity that would allow further development in their country towards things like the internet, which, as we've seen, is a massively democratizing force out in the rest of the world. This is an opportunity to help the developing countries move leaps ahead, rather than considering how we can export 3 years ago's technology to.
Definitely places where we see unrest or see sort of a destabilization. And as Bruce had said previously, places where there's no real good options for like solar or wind, places like Siberia and various other sort of out there, like you said, West Africa, definitely. No, I definitely think that would help, especially there's a concept that's been floating around on the internet for almost 2 years now, I want to say, about a new generation of nuclear reactor called the thorium pebble bed reactor, which uses a sealed reactor in a small-scale way, as opposed to a large-scale, like most of your modern nuclear reactors, where it's one reactor or a couple of reactors providing power for a like an entire province or state or region. It's smaller reactors that use less fuel more efficiently in a smaller area, maybe the size of a neighborhood, or at most maybe a city, depending on what size you're looking at. There are also some advantages of using thorium as a fuel as well in its inability to be weaponized compared to other nuclear fuels that we've used in the past.
The political ramifications of that are pretty profound. Countries that say they want nuclear power and we were like, well, we think we want nuclear weapons. We said, yeah, have a thorium reactor. Do you want it? And if you say no, well, we knew what you were after. Also, if it's a smaller scale and you have more of them, that does change very much that risk profile that is so unique with nuclear, of having a very, very, very low chance of a very, very catastrophic or dramatic thing, which is what makes it such a political hot button. If something will almost certainly do a slight amount of environmental damage all the time, we figure it's worth the risk. But if it has a 1 in 1,000,000 chance of having a huge, horrific thing happen, that's dramatic. That makes newspapers. Even if it doesn't happen, it could. That is what will get written. But if something has a moderate chance of a moderate problem, we might put up with that.
Well, we definitely saw that kind of over-reporting of extreme possibilities when the particle collider at CERN was being turned on. The Large Hadron Collider hadn't even been started yet, and yet the news outlets were already talking about miniature black holes and the danger they might create. And it's like, well, okay, that is a very extreme possibility. We kind of hoped that maybe something like that would happen, but not because it's dangerous, because we wanted to see, like, this would tell us a huge new thing about how this happens. And yet, we went immediately to the worst-case scenario, where the Earth is somehow consumed by our own hubris, in this case.
Actually, as far as the Large Hadron Collider goes, it would indeed create microscopic black holes, but they're actually so small they'll eat maybe 100 protons before eventually fizzling out, because they can't support their own mass.
There will definitely be some kind of over-reporting of the 1 in 1,000,000 dangers. But the specific part of the unrest situation that I was pointing to is, even if you don't imagine a country whose government is not stable enough to have access to nuclear, if we imagine a government that is trying to keep control of a restless population, possibly because they're in desperate poverty, like in the case of Yemen, for example, setting up solar there is very difficult because the populace, being largely so poor as to need whatever resources they can get, will go out and tear down development to sell it to the highest scrap dealer to get food for the next day. I'm not saying we should demonize those people for that, because obviously they're in a very difficult situation, but as an outside aid agency, it must make it very difficult to go in and build something like that. It's much harder to go in and tear down a thorium reactor and sell it to the nearest scrap dealer.
Because you can put it in a building and guard it.
Exactly. Which means that the possibility of putting a single location that has a well-guarded standing and is not as vulnerable to that kind of unrest could provide power for the entire countryside, and that might be a game-changer in terms of the ability to put power in these countries.
Yeah, there are a lot of positive political ramifications. When we think about consistent power that can be protected and can be placed anywhere, independent of location. There are a lot of countries that really need that. There's the internet ramifications, but then again, on the other hand, if you're, let's say, the person in charge of this country, you actually want to give your people consistent power because that does cut down unrest.
Well, we can just look at Lagos, Nigeria, to see an example of a city that has been very negatively impacted by power cuts. For the most part, Lagos is a thriving metropolis with a lot of trade going on, but during the times when power cuts are going on, street gangs take advantage of the fact that the streetlights aren't on and no one can tell what's happening to perpetrate violence and personal attacks and robberies and the like. The civil unrest caused by the opportunity created by the power cut is actually more detrimental to Lagos than almost any other factor going on.
Both of you have said a good way to bring the rest or all of the world forward. I mean, as a global civilization, if you will, is to make sure that we can provide power to everyone who wants it. And that's something we've been sorely falling down on across the years. And everybody says they want to help or they want to do this thing or that thing for this in a country that is either experiencing unrest or some sort of impoverished state. And almost universally, what's being suggested is stopgap measures at best. Other times it's token attempts at help, for lack of a better term. And I definitely think things like the thorium pebble bed reactor and various other semi-long-term, low-risk, high-reward solutions to certain things like power concerns will definitely help stabilize and definitely help in a very real way.
Do we have, in some sense, an obligation to future generations to provide technologies that are less likely to be harmful to them?
I don't even know if we need to go as far as future generations. I mean, we're seeing the negative impacts of the technologies on us. And this is much of externalized costs in economics, which is where the negative consequences of the behavior of a person or a corporation are pushed onto other people. And when we talk about environmental impact, very often what we're talking about is less obvious ways in which person A is screwing over person B. You can't necessarily see it directly. He didn't walk up and punch him, but he's pooping in the river and he lives upstream. So when we talk about, you know, environmental impact, we're really talking about ways in which we're harming each other, not necessarily intentionally, but thoughtlessly, and it's less obvious. We can detect it, but we have to think about it a little bit to see it. But it is basically externalized cost. It's hurting us now. Sure, it's going to hurt future generations, but even before we get to justifying whether we owe anything to future generations, well, we can talk about the fact that we're hurting one another right now by doing these sorts of things.
I personally feel that trying to provide a better world or a better solution for people down the road from us is in many ways a good thing, but I don't think that precludes things like nuclear power. Yes, there is waste from it. Yes, there is this 1 in 1 million or 1 in 10 million danger of a very localized disaster happening. But the simple fact that we, going forward, are always looking for a better way to dispose of our waste, and the fact that the waste is incredibly localized, along with better and better safety practices that keep reducing the chances of a localized disaster event over time, makes it a less risky proposition than, say, burning hydrocarbons, burning coal, burning oil, natural gas for power, and which I personally feel has a much larger impact over a greater area over time than, say, something like the Fukushima disaster, where we're already seeing cleanup efforts work to lower the radiation from the disaster and the government being able to reclaim the land and bring people back into it. Very slowly, mind you, but newer technologies that are contributing to this cleanup are being developed constantly. We are creating better shielding materials for the machines we use to help clean it up, and the fact that a lot of folks are working on making reactor casings and housings and various parts of power plants stronger and stronger and less likely to succumb to the effects of radiation means that it's becoming a smaller and smaller problem over time.
The worst case scenario of a small, local, self-contained thorium pebble bed reactor is much, much smaller than a giant, you know, the plant that services three states.
Actually, the reason that I posed the question the way that I did is because, at least for me, it leads to a very specific answer. And that's that whether or not we owe some obligation to future generations to have instilled the cleanest possible technology in our power generation, we owe something that I consider more important to those future generations. And that's the advances that will be made through the study of nuclear power. No other area has yielded such fruitful scientific understanding of the world around us, and to deny future generations access to the research that will come about through finding the practical applications of our nuclear science would actually be to set them back even further in the attempt for human beings to understand the grandeur of the universe around us. While it would be great if we can find a technology that helps save the planet in the meantime and make sure that we don't face environmental consequences, to eliminate the science that would be done in the pursuit of that technology would be to limit our far future generations and to reduce their capability to expand out into the stars, to understand the world better, and to perhaps leave behind the brief period that we spent on the Earth being birthed into this universe. I think that that's a far more important goal. Not wiping out the human race is very important, obviously. But making sure that the Earth is absolutely pristine is a little less important to me than making sure that human beings understand the world that they go out into more.
The concept of a pristine Earth, I think, is a utopian ideal. It can't happen. We've already changed the face of the Earth. We've changed the face of the creatures that live on it. And at some point, we're going to have to realize that we are going to design what the biosphere looks like. And to say, well, let's let everything be natural, is sort of wash our hands of the responsibility that we can't put back. We can design a nice one that's very green and has lots of, you know, biodiversity and stuff like that, and I think we should try to, but we're going to have to. We're going to have to actually accept the responsibility that we are shaping the planet, whether intentionally or not, and we're going to do a better job of it if we do it intentionally.
Without having events like Fukushima and Chernobyl, we wouldn't know what the long-term effects of radiation is on biological material, both plant and animal life, which is something incredibly important in spacefaring because radiation pervades all parts of the universe. Part of the reason we haven't had a mission to Mars yet is because to send someone to Mars and bring them back actually exposes them to more radiation than is within the safety guidelines of most major space organizations. And because we're still developing the technology to properly shield them, to prevent them from being exposed to that much radiation, it has stopped us from going to another planet.
So in the terms of the potential very, very long-term survival of the human species, This is going to be necessary. We're going to need to know this stuff if we ever want to get off the planet and go somewhere else.
Oh, absolutely. And without knowing, if we could rewind and go back and never have nuclear science develop, Marie Curie never wins the Nobel Prize, never does the treatise on radium that far back, Manhattan Project never happens, so on and so forth. The first time we send people into space unshielded, without any protection whatsoever, suddenly it's going to be real dangerous being out there because we're going to have people coming back with weird illnesses and exposure to cosmic radiation that's going to cause them to basically fall apart, and maybe we don't get much further than high Earth orbit in the first place.
Given the condition of current science journalism, I'm sure all the headlines would scream, "Outer space is poison!"
I think probably the most important element of this, in my mind anyway, is that while it would be nice to go back in history and to pretend that we could somehow change the mistakes that we've made with the information we have now, it is on the backs of those very tragic mistakes that science is propelled forward. Is it worth the cost? I have to think so. We exist in the way we do because of the mistakes that came before us. There are many regrettable moments, both in science and cultural history, that it would be nice to be able to go and take back. But without them, we don't arrive where we are. And without tomorrow's mistakes, we don't get on to the day after that. It's unfortunate that that's the way that humans know how to understand the world. But we can't be other than what we are. And I'm not prepared to say human progress should stop in favor of some sort of naturalistic, holistic view of the world where we just sit happily in our dung pile and eat whatever berries are available.
If we ever find a way of advancing applied science without making errors, without trial and error, that'll be great. But we're never going to find that without making a few more errors on the way. And future emerging technologies of various kinds, we are going to do horrible things and terrible things are going to happen. And we're just going to have to power through it. That's how it is. Of all the energy generation methods, if we're talking hydroelectric or solar or wind or even petrochemical, improving those are all basically engineering problems at this point. A little bit of an exception for solar. There might be some, you know, electrodynamic improvements that could be discovered. Nuclear gets to basic physics. Improving nuclear is improving our knowledge of what the universe is made of itself. The best thing to learn along the way.
Bruce, silence. River, I grant unto you the last word.
Thank you, Professor. I think that if we're going to pursue nuclear going forward, we need to look at some of the very serious social policies and political policies that various groups have taken, various countries have taken over the years in regards to responsibility concerning nuclear power and definitely with nuclear accidents. After the Chernobyl disaster, while Soviet troops were trying to clean up and control a severe radiation leak, there were people in Moscow concocting fake numbers and stories and who to lay the blame upon and this, that, and the other thing that they presented to the international nuclear community as if it were fact, and that's a problem. They used numbers that were botched because they used numbers from radiation counters that only went up to a certain amount. When they read them, they saw that number, and they also saw that those counters had broken because it had gone well beyond those charts. And so they tried to minimize as much as possible the actual effect of the disaster, and that ended up causing a lot of problems down the road, both very quickly with some of the people affected directly that lived in Pripyat and the surrounding area that we've come to know as the Ukraine Chernobyl Zone of Alienation, as well as people in Belarusia, where a lot of the fallout first came down upon after it was blown into the atmosphere, and all over parts of Eastern Europe. And a lot of these people didn't get the proper help they needed because their government was telling them that, no, they're just sick, they aren't being exposed to radiation. They were lying to their people and themselves and the international nuclear community as a whole to try and cover this up. And that has caused, and still to this day, causes problems. There are people who have not gotten properly compensated who were on the Chernobyl cleanup team that still live, that have experienced long-term effects of radiation exposure. And again, in Fukushima, the next largest nuclear disaster, we've seen some cover-up by the company running the nuclear power plant, as well as some of the prefecture government fudging the numbers, not nearly to the extent that happened with Chernobyl, but we started seeing some things that didn't jive come out about Fukushima and sort of trying to damage control in a political sense to try and make themselves look not, or make it look like things aren't as bad as they were. And I think that's a big problem. If we're going to deal with something as potentially dangerous as nuclear power and nuclear generation in any scale, I think it behooves us to take responsibility for it. If something happens, we need to, whoever it comes down upon, if that 1 in 10 million chance takes over, or goes super critical, or there's a radiation leak or something, those in charge of it need to take responsibility. Otherwise, you're going to have a lot more pushback over time. That has certainly hurt the cause of nuclear power in the time that the actual facts have come out, and will continue to into the future. So if we're going to keep going forward, we need to be straightforward. We need to say, yes, we screwed up. This is what we did wrong. This is what we could do better. And address that fully, as opposed to trying to cover it up in a political sense, because that helps no one and certainly hurts a lot more people down the road, and certainly hurts the cause of nuclear power. I think in the end it'll benefit all of us, everyone, if we're just own up, basically, to what we screwed up in the past or what we are going to screw up in the future.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. Don't forget to subscribe and review on iTunes, follow us on Twitter, and if you like what we're doing, support us on Patreon. Join us next time after the Steves finish training my army of sea monkeys to smoke cigars. I've been your host, Professor Metal.
I'm Sean.
I'm Bruce.
And I'm River. Hey guys, I got this great tan sitting by the professor's new indoor pool.
Holy smokes, I gotta get a beach towel.
Who's up for neon margaritas?
Security slave.